to everybody who has made this year so great for us here, the library, our partners, Vallum, all the writers who've come, and especially you guys for showing up. So thank you. This is going to be our last reading of 2014. Our new schedule for the following year is going to be up quite soon. So thanks a lot. We're joined tonight by two excellent poets, Suvankam Talavangsa and Chris Hutchinson. I'm going to pass you off to my co-host, who's going to introduce Chris, who's reading first. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. I'm Charlotte. Chris Hutchinson was born in Montreal, grew up in Vancouver, and has since pursued various livelihoods, including cooking in restaurants, working in offices, and occasionally teaching creative writing in high schools, colleges, and universities. He's made his home in such places as Dawson City, Kelowna, New York City, and most recently, Houston, Texas. He's the author of three previous books of poetry. His most recent, Jonas in Frames, an epic, is a novel in poetic form. Please welcome Chris Hutchinson.
Thank you, Charlotte and Simon. And it's an honor to read at the last Atwater reading of the year. So I'm just going to read the prologue of the book, and then I'll pause and maybe talk a little bit about the book, and then read two more short pieces from Jonas in Frames. So this is the prologue. It is not an extraordinary existence at the corner of West 12th Street and nowhere. How can he justify the air moving through his lungs, the blood through his heart, the sweat through his pores? Jonas lives in a small ground-level apartment, which wicks the summer's late afternoon sun through the living room window. Dusky heat spills over a frayed floral brocade sofa and floods the length of the unvarnished hardwood floor. A Leo, 29 as of today, he is average-looking and of medium build, though he sometimes worries that his head is too big for his body and dreams of one day owning a blue felt fedora that actually fits. He's got a real melon, a planetoid, a brain with a veritable mind of its own, and an imagination that won't quit. His sofa, he sees, is fizzing with dust marks, punctuation marks of his life's invisible script. To beat the heat and to celebrate the evening, Jonas drinks Chinese cooking wine with ice at his kitchen's bar counter. He wishes Helen of Troy were here, or Cleopatra, or a young Jane Fonda. He wishes he wouldn't wish so much, or at least wish for practical things like stocks or government bonds. But money is the obsession of people other than himself. The word career, an echo from a faraway universe, from a time before the cursed deluge known as the Devil's Water. He peels the label away from the bottle, revealing a window of dark glass. Bananas, he read somewhere, contain a natural antidepressant, their soft flesh a materialized form of sunlight. So he tries to remember to mash half of one into his cornflakes each morning. But too often, he forgets. His freezer, subsequently, has become a morgue for black bananas he can't bring himself to discard. So, cracking another ice cube into his glass, he fills the tray's vacant squares with water and tops up his wine. He's not sad, just resigned to his solitude and poverty, and the steady purr of traffic along 12th Street lulls him into a feeling of detached security as night comes on. A siren cuts the air, warping into the far distance to indicate yet another otherworldly emergency. Someone's chamomile tea-drinking aunt must have fallen asleep while crocheting, and her menthol cigarette, dropping from her ashtray into a cardboard box full of newly made doilies, must have set the whole house ablaze. Or someone's cousin must have gone off his meds and wandered into traffic, thinking the oncoming headlights were the welcoming eyes of ethereal beings. Or someone's ex-husband's long journey through time must have ended with manuscript pages ripped into shreds and tossed like so many suicide notes over the guardrail of the Lionsgate Bridge. Jonas thinks, disasters surround me, seas of confusion. He refills his glass, sets sail to swelling breakers, but forgets to tie himself to the mast. The moon comes up full and squints through the branches and heart-shaped leaves of the chestnut. Now is the hour when silence unfolds its want-had for remembrance, when Jonas must resist punishing himself for everything he's either never attempted or tried and failed at. His father used to shout at him, name one thing you can do, one thing that's useful, one thing you're good at. Then his teachers joined in, his gurus, his guides, and his friends. The voice in his head wants to speak, taunting him with the line, in the kingdom of the afterlife, nothing's ironic, which he thinks to write down, but doesn't, not yet. Instead, he swims out to his sofa, now floating in moonlight, where the dust motes have turned to vibrating stars. Draining his glass, then stretching out and closing his eyes, he begins, it is not an extraordinary existence at the corner of West 12th Street and nowhere. Here, several pages have been lost. So as you might have guessed, I'm not reading from a book of poetry, exactly. Then again, maybe I am. I like to think of the book, at this point, it's come to be something like a novel disguised as a picaresque, or sorry, an epic poem disguised as a picaresque novel. The people over at the Library and Archives Canada cataloging and publication called the book, what do they call it? It's here at the very beginning. It's a novel in poetic form, which Charlotte has pointed out, which is my least favorite definition, but I mean, so take your pick. So irrespective of genre, the next kind of micro chapter I'll read, it's called Jonas and Paroxysms, and it occurs after the main character has suffered some kind of seizure. And what follows is a kind of mix-up of flashbacks and flash-forwards. And these basically mirror the character's fragmented psyche, consciousness, maybe his soul, you could say. It also anticipates the episodic and temporally irregular, let's say, structure of the book. So this is Jonas and Paroxysms. On Vancouver Island, in grade 3, Jonas marries his rosy-cheeked sweetheart, Gretchen Snyder, between the rows of bike racks beside the big hill. This is Friday after school. Yes, Jonas, sometimes life is grand. He rides home at top speed, the peeling paint on his BMX bike's rusty handlebars vibrating in the wind. Perhaps even feels the hair follicles on his arms twitching in the rush of air, fluttering through every golden superlative. On Monday, at morning recess, Jonas discovers Gretchen pushing Scott Gamble up against the kissing wall behind the gym. Life is over, Ben. Something breaks and slips loose like a chain off a bike on a downhill ride. Jonas loses focus and swerves and falls through a Jonas-shaped hole in the world. There's an acrid taste of failure, a confusion of depth. The jeweled eyes of minnows, the caressing seaweed strands where breakers wing to shore, and the sun above, the phosphorescent lure. Next, the blue heron is the neck tattoo of choice of the clownish art school dropouts whose figures sift the air made soft as flakes of gold in the last rays of sun on Saint Laurent Boulevard. They are trying to ignore a furrow-browed man who shakes coins inside his cup. It is the remnants of himself that he's rattling, of a life answerable to no one. Later, in a piano bar in a parallel universe, on the ledge of a window with a view of the muddy Yukon River glinting through a screen of birch, wildflowers wilt inside a ceramic vase. Heads hang abjectly, purple petals squeezed shut in perpetual sleep, exhausted leaves of hands crumpled, submissive to the pull of earth. Beside the window, suspended by two chains, a framed plaque reads, "I wanted the gold, and I sought it. I scrabbled and mucked like a slave. Was it famine or scurvy? I fought it. I hurled my youth into a grave." It's Robert Service, obviously. But no, this is Skid Row, the downtown east side. A room with a view of Chinatown, the beginning of everything Jonas will never comprehend, a riddle he solves by simply dissolving, muscles shifting, loosening, strength leaking out through punctured flesh, and streaming into the neon lights reflected on wet streets. Meanwhile, Jonas sleeps several meters beneath the sea, inside a leafing live oak, where he skims through volume 6 of an old Encyclopedia Britannica. Even in this place, how the past continues to dictate his dreams, telling his story, which Jonas reads, is reflected in the constellations wheeling round Polaris. Then, way-faced and wry-sensed, he is lost in the crush of pedestrian traffic. Wafts of air, metallic, putrid, blend with his body's sweat. Each pore breathes out a little filth, breathes in the streets of Brooklyn. With every step, he becomes more convinced that his evil twin is a bride's groom, soaking in a bath of ice-cold Perrier. Or, prone to speculations about visitors from space, to paranoid conjectures about being scrutinized and dissected, to suspicions that he has been programmed by nefarious algorithms, and to the habit of drifting off into any number of subjective universes, perhaps Jonas writes words inside his head to resist being himself written on or through. Now, sea air swells the wooden doors shut. Inside a story set in the land of fog, stuck in a warehouse wallpapered with can-can girls dancing in endless rows, a flashing decorating idea from some bygone era, Jonas touches his index finger to his nose, confirming that yes, in a previous life he drove an unlicensed cab in Sao Paulo. Then, in 1971, he is born on the doorstep of Mount Royal, a not-so-empty vessel. But by 1974, although his father's mind has turned to fractals, and his mother's soul has flown the wrong way through time to relive her sins in the center of Quebec, they somehow all managed to move out west. Backdropped by blue mountains, cedar sentinels guard the sea's edge. Jonas recalls the fern pollen, which looked like rust as it stuck to the white vinyl siding of his father's garage, is the image of the beginning of a lifelong depression. And it is here, out west, while attending Clearview Elementary School, where Jonas marries for the first and last time, then fights in the Great Pinecone War for the Big Hill. Here, where the girls wear pigtails and Daisy Duke overalls, and the boys in their gumboots are indistinguishable from the grief-stricken fishermen of Nanoose Bay. His teacher's voice has followed him through the years. "If you're too lazy to learn your multiplication tables, then you won't be able to move up a grade. And later in life, when you don't have a job, where will you go, and what will you do when you don't have any money?" After Gretchen and the war, there is Cecily, then Melanie, then comes grade 4. And I'll finish with a piece near the end of the book called The Good Life. And at this point, all we really have to know is that Jonas is kind of, he's moved around a lot. His tragedy is that he's lost everything without really knowing that he had anything to begin with. Just to kind of give you a little bit of an insight. And at this point, he's in San Francisco. He's kind of moving around visiting people, and he's got some friends who live in the Berkeley Hills. They have a nice view of the Golden Gate Bridge. And so he goes and visits these old friends. And this is called The Good Life. Everywhere he goes, Jonas visits the same long-lost friends. Now, all of them have babies. They have pink-headed babies with slobbery jowls. They have toothless, sponge-cake-faced babies with sea anemones for hands. Babies are strapped into jolly jumpers, towered in high chairs, stationed at rocket ship control centers. Pop star babies, clown cheek babies, and mastermind babies snuffling and ferreting under the blanket for leaky nipple. There are babies popping up like corks in all the rivers and oceans. There are mushroom babies sprouting from the sodden soil. Aliens, invaders of planet Earth, this pox of babies, this plague of fecundity, star seeds falling from the night sky. Jonas smiles weakly. He is weak in the knees, he is weak in the stomach, he is weak in forethought and in hindsight. He has a weakness for single malt whiskeys and for sexy flight attendants who check in on a timely basis. Fat and sleepy-eyed, his friends invite him to sit, relax. Doffing autumnal scarves, they say they have just strolled back from the craft fair where they bought books on the art of edible origami and local art history. Now they litter their monologues with the famous last words of wildlife painters. Every work, she is reputed to have said, was a reproach. They have a miniature schnauzer and a collection of rare vinyl no one is allowed to touch. They possess lemon zesters, garage door openers, and a vast knowledge of the vicissitudes of the NASDAQ. They wear the translucent skin of the well-fed and the spiritually indifferent. Jonas has bad breath. He is bad with small talk, and the botched fledgling of his polite laughter tumbles from its branch. He'll never admit to his sour habit of gritting his teeth whenever he thinks he hears someone speaking his name with a forced lack of derision. He fumbles the joke of his employment history and misses every triple word score. So, are you seeing anyone? They are always so gracious to ask. Yes, replies Jonas. Tara and I have been together for a while now. Oh, I mean Ursula. But anyway, we broke up. How can he explain? There are years of his life he can't even think about, let alone discuss. While his alibis have become so multiple and varied to have entangled him, he imagines, in sticky strands of spider spit. Guilt is a trap his past has invented and set as a means of revenge and not a suitable item for a genteel chap. Jonas thinks it is better to bring up anything else but maybe the issue of Beethoven's possible Moorish roots, but not remembering any pertinent details of proof, he quietly helps himself to more crackers. But his friends are kind. When he sneezes and farts, their eyes sparkle and flicker like the edges of a 1980s television screen. Not surprisingly, his cover-up coughing fit stretches the limits of the space-time continuum. Dinner is served and comes with more than one bottle of Barossa Valley Shiraz, wherein his hosts happily inform him are hints of fantastic farmhouse noises, Madagascar spies, Chicago cherries, licorice breath, dryads, nerds, and vanilla ice undertones. Indeed, Jonas is becoming acutely aware of the liquid's enormous complexity, delivered through the throat and nose and into the mind with a Claude Monet water lilies of style, yet haunted by an inescapable sense of Amelia Earhart's death wish. You know, you are always welcome, they attempt to say, though the baby is crying now, mimicking an air raid siren, its face a red agony. Seriously, anything you need. Trying not to teeter too much in the doorway, Jonas is neither arriving nor departing. A tight rope of a smile stretches across his face. Before him, his wine-flushed friends, the smell of new bread, a glowing hearth, a wailing newborn, bundled in rosy globes of flesh. Behind him, the bridge's fire-colored towers stab through frozen mists. Jonas is trying to balance on the edge of a precipice. He has a weak jaw, a weak disposition, a weak way of saying goodbye. Thanks for the conversation and the fine wine. Great to see you two again. And hey, congrats on the rug rat.
Thanks very much.